From Silicon Valley, California, this is Fresh Dialogues. Guy Kawasaki is a Silicon Valley venture capitalist, co-founder of Alltop, columnist, author, and sought-after speaker, but is probably best known as Apple's evangelist. He's the one who helped launch the Macintosh computer in the 80s. Guy, thank you for joining me today on Fresh Dialogues.
Sure. It's a long time ago, the 80s.
Yes, indeed. 25 years indeed. Ago. Yeah. So, Guy, you have a very loyal following. Some even call you a legend, a Silicon Valley legend in our time.
That's a nice word for being over the hill, basically.
How do you feel about that, that loyal following and being known as a legend?
Well, I would dispute that I am a legend, first of all. I think, you know, Wozniak is a legend. I'm flattered. I would not turn it down, but I don't think I deserve it. How's that?
Do you feel you need to do more?
Well, presuming that I'd want to be a legend, yes. But one could make the case that legends don't have the upfront motivation and desire to be a legend, and that true legends, it's sort of after the fact they become a legend. It's not like you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you're a 18-year-old or 19-year-old MBA and you're sitting there saying, "I'm gonna be a legend. That's my goal in life." I think you're not gonna make it. What you should do is, you know, create a great product or service, and you know, if you do that, maybe you'll be a legend. But the goal is not to be a legend. The goal is to change the world. And I could make the case that there are many people who have changed the world who are not legends, for example.
Do you feel you have changed the world?
In a small way, because I was part of an organization, the Mac division, that changed the world. But I would not also hold myself out as someone who changed the world.
Well, let's go back to your childhood. You grew up in Hawaii.
Yes.
Your father, I understand, was a fireman, a real estate broker, and a state senator.
In that order, yeah.
Did his constantly reinventing himself, did that rub off on you?
Well, it's always romantic to look back and say, you know, his father reinvented himself, so that's why he's so flexible, or he was abused as, no, not me, but, you know, he was abused and deprived of as a child. So that's when he got his toughness and his entrepreneurial spirit. Or at 12 years old, he had the most successful, you know, lemonade stand in Honolulu. Same thing happens in sports, you know, that people say, well, even at 5 years old, he was swinging a golf club or he was shooting baskets. But the problem, I think, with that kind of theory is that there are lots of kids shooting baskets at five, right? And so one of them becomes a Michael Jordan, and everybody says, yeah, you know, he was shooting baskets at five. Well, there were 10,000 other kids who did not become Michael Jordan. So, you know, if the theory is if you're 5 years old, you're shooting baskets, you'll become Michael Jordan, it ain't that simple, right? I tell you what my father did do. With total certainty, my father taught me not to take any shit from anybody, without question.
Good lesson. And how did he teach that, Guy?
Because as a senator, he took on people. He took on unions. He took on the governor. He took on the mayor. He took on people. And that I learned from him for sure.
And do you refuse to take shit today from anyone?
I wouldn't say anyone. There are a handful of people I do. But generally speaking, I have a very low tolerance. And I think that it's only since I've turned 50 that I really sort of blossomed in that sense. Because when I turned 50, I decided that most of my life is over and life is too short. And so I wasn't going to take it anymore. And so there are things I pass on. There are people I don't deal with. I don't care. I am particularly in my online presence on Twitter and stuff, that there are instances where I should be more empathetic, I should be more explanatory, I should be more whatever, and I'm not. So I can love it or leave it, basically.
And tell me, as a child, Guy, What were your influences? What did you want to be when you were 5 years old?
I don't remember. You know, I really think when people say, you know, ever since I was 5, I wanted to be a whatever. I think that's retroactively inventing your memories. I can't even remember what I wanted to be at 5. You know, probably a football player. You know, maybe Superman. I don't know. One of the Three Stooges. I have no idea. I don't remember.
But what about that entrepreneurial spirit? Where did it come from? Can you trace it back? Or did it start at Apple?
It probably started in the Mac division when I saw people starting software companies and, you know, creating these great products and, getting the reward and the independence and all that. So if you interview Richard Branson, ask him at age 5, does he always wanted to own an airline and fly? I doubt it, because Richard Branson told me the story that the way he decided to get in the airline business is he was, I don't know, stuck in the Virgin Islands or something, and he couldn't get a flight, so he chartered an airplane, and he went through the terminal and said, you know, this plane is going to go from here to wherever, and there are X seats, and so anybody wants a seat, it's X pounds each or X dollars each, and he filled the flight, and then he figured out, maybe it should be in the airline business, right? That's very different than saying, well, at age 5, he would go with his father to the airfield, and, you know, he always wanted to be a pilot, and at 15, he was the youngest licensed pilot in England, and, you know, at 20, he flew for the Royal Air Force, and, you know, that's the romantic version, right? In fact, he was just pissed off because he couldn't get from one island to another in the Virgin Islands or something.
Has being pissed off encouraged you to take things on? I mean, is that...
Not really. I mean, more it's... I think the better test for an entrepreneur is that you create something that you yourself want to use. Now, it can be in a situation that you're pissed off that you figure out there must be a better way. But I don't think anger is necessarily the sole mother of entrepreneurship.
And going back to school days, you majored in psychology. Has that been a useful tool for you or useful wisdom?
I suppose that you could try to connect the dots and say, well, he majored in psych and now he's an evangelist and a sales guy and a marketing guy and an entrepreneur, and he's very active on social media. So, you know, let's draw those dots and connect them. You could do that. The truth is that psych was the easiest major I could find at Stanford.
Talking about Apple, what would you say is the difference between an evangelist and just a sales or marketing guy?
The difference between an evangelist and a sales and marketing guy is an evangelist has the other person's best interest at heart, and a salesperson has their own interest at heart, and that is a crucial difference. And many salespeople will take offense to that, and some might even say that the best salespeople are looking out for their customer, not just themselves. But I would make the case that if a salesperson has that attitude, that person is, in fact, an evangelist. Perhaps has never heard the term.
And what was it about the Apple products, specifically the Macintosh, that made you feel
evangelistic?
Evangelistic. I've got to help people find this and change their lives.
Evangelism comes from the Greek words to bring the good news. And so you have to have a product or service that you believe is good news. I believed Macintosh was good news. It made you more creative and productive. I probably could not evangelize Vista, for example. Right. It's not clear to me that's good news. Now, there may be people who do believe Vista is good news, and they can be evangelists. So one of the things is I think great evangelists are made. They are not born. And so you are made an evangelist when you either create or come across something that you view as good news. So anybody can be an evangelist. It's not a character personality. It's not a certain gene that's been activated. It's not in your DNA.
And the word evangelist, it has a kind of religious quality about it. Is that relevant in your case? Is religion part of your life?
Yeah, religion is definitely part of my life, but it is not why I became a Macintosh evangelist. But yes, but the two are not really related.
Did you ever work closely with Steve Jobs?
Yes.
And how was that?
It was a very interesting, valuable, and unusual experience. I owe a lot to him. Arguably, I owe everything to him because I really established my reputation in the Mac division. He is one of a kind.
And what specifically did you learn from him, Guy?
Many things. I learned that good design is very valuable. I think I learned how far people can be pushed and how much better they can do if you do push them. There's things I learned in the Mac division not from him. For example, I learned that the best product doesn't always win, unfortunately. I also learned how much people who believe in your product can help you. And that wasn't from him either. That was from people who loved Macintosh.
Great. And what about Steve Wozniak?
Steve Wozniak, I never worked directly with. I came in after him. I've come to know him. I think he's sort of the purest form of engineering that there is. And I have great admiration for him, but I can't say I ever worked with him.
Right. And you recently reviewed one of his, not his books, but a book about
him.
Yeah,
Gina Smith wrote a book called I Was. And I reviewed it and liked it very much.
Would you recommend it to entrepreneurs?
Absolutely. Particularly engineers, because I think it shows the purity of what great engineering is.
And talking of books, you have written 9 books,
yes.
I understand. One of your favorite books that you recommend on your website is The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen.
Yes.
Why is it top of your list, Guy?
Well, it's because so many companies fall victim to The Innovator's Dilemma, which is basically if you become successful, then there's all this pressure and momentum for you to constantly fix that product, make it better, drive down the cost, you know, all that kind of stuff. So you're focused on that because your customers are asking for that. Your sales force is asking for that. Everybody's asking for that. But truly, the innovator's dilemma is for you to be able to create a product that kills that product. And that's a very hard thing to do because nobody's asking for it. You know, if you walk into an Apple store right now, no one's going to say, create a product that'll kill a Macintosh. Right, and if you ask the Apple sales force, nobody's going to say it. Nobody's going to say that. But if you don't do it, somebody else will. And so no one was asking for a product to kill the Apple II, but that's what Macintosh did. And so, you know, ironically, as you get more and more successful and you have more and more resources to do more and more things, you can't. or it's a very difficult mental, you know, leap to do it.
What specifically can green entrepreneurs learn from that book, would you say?
They can learn, if they're competing with an existing large company, perhaps insights in how to defeat that large company. Because, you know, you always think, well, wouldn't it be great to work for this large company? You have infinite money, infinite brand awareness, infinite production, infinite everything. And you'd see it's not so easy. You know, the grass is browner sometimes. I think that is interesting. I think it's also interesting if a green entrepreneur achieves a modicum of success that you should figure out that you're going to have an innovator's dilemma. That, you know, if you create the ultimate solar panel, then you're going to drive the cost down. You're going to make it more efficient. You're going to, you know, whatever. And somebody else is going to have a new technology and you're going to say, well, we can't switch to that because no one's asking for that. And then, you know.
Right.
I mean, just imagine all the people who are so dependent on the oil business. You know, they're the last people who are going to switch. That's the innovator's dilemma.
Okay, and let's talk about your books. One of your books sounds fascinating to me. It's called Rules for Revolutionaries.
Yes.
And there's been a lot said about the green revolution going on right now. You've said the greatest role in life is being a revolutionary and making the world a better place. In what ways is that true for you?
Well, I would like to amend that a little bit. I think perhaps the greatest role in life is to be a father or mother. I think that is arguably more valuable. Most entrepreneurs won't agree with that. But let's say the second most is to look back on your life and say, I brought a Macintosh to life. I brought Google to life. I brought Yahoo, I brought Cisco to life, and I made people's lives better with better search, better personal computer, better data access, whatever it is. I don't see how it can get better than that.
Let's talk about your rules for revolutionaries. Mm-hmm. You've said being revolutionary is not about 10% better. It's about jumping the curve mm-hmm. and changing the world. Mm-hmm. So talking about the Green Revolution, what specific advice would you give Green Revolutionaries about making the leap and defying common ways of thinking today?
The true test of an entrepreneur or innovation is not to do something 10% better. To use a historical example, if you were in the letter quality daisy wheel printer business, you could make a daisy wheel printer that has 10% more fonts, 10% more sizes, 10% faster, 10% cheaper, whatever, right? But truly, the revolution occurred on the next curve, which is the laser printer curve. Now, if you're on the laser printer curve, now you're duking it out. You're trying to make it cheaper, faster, higher resolution, all that stuff. But then what's the next curve in the printer business? So you could say that in the same way, in the Green Revolution, to use a facetious example, you could make a shower head that used 10% less water, right? Is that a revolution?
Right. Good point.
And so the true test is, are you jumping to a different curve? Are you making a slightly better showerhead? Are you making a slightly better hybrid? Are you making a slightly better diesel? That's the test. And now, don't get me wrong, in some places, like maybe solar panels, to do a solar panel 10% better is so hard that that is a curve jump. So it's not just the 10%, it's just, how hard is what you're doing? Does it change the game? Because perhaps by making a solar panel that's 10% better and 10% cheaper, we can go from $100,000 solar panel installations to $10,000 solar panel installations. That is a big deal, right?
Right.
So it's all about jumping curves.
Okay. And you talk specifically about death magnets.
Yes.
Can you describe what challenges and pitfalls someone in the Green Revolution might face and how they can
A death magnet, first of all, let me define, is something that when you encounter it, you know it might kill you. You've been told it might kill you. You've been warned, et cetera, but you still do it. And it's because of inertia, momentum, whatever it is.
Can you give us an example?
In the Green Revolution or anywhere in the world?
In the Green Revolution, if you can.
I'm not that versed in the Green Revolution, but let's suppose that it's an accepted practice that in the solar panel business, everybody uses national distributors with wholesalers, retailers, and installers. So everybody does that. And you look at that and you say, I have to do it that way too, because everybody else in the industry does, right? Then somebody else comes along and says, yeah, but the problem with that is you don't control the quality of the installation. You don't control the people. You don't control that. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do something different. I'm going to control from the time you buy the solar panel to the time it's done on your house. It's going to be my, whatever. You could make the case either one of those could be a death magnet. I don't know. I don't know in this business, right? But, to say that you always have to use a three-tier distribution channel might be a death magnet. Or to believe that you can control all three tiers and scale might be a death magnet.
Can you give a specific from an industry you know well so that we can demonstrate this point to entrepreneurs listening? What was a death magnet for Apple?
When the iPhone came out, they did not let any developers write software. Their first response was, it has to work as a Safari plugin. That was a death magnet. The thinking was, we need to control the experience. We need to certify that apps are great and all that kind of stuff. So we have to force them through using Safari. That was a death magnet. And as you see, when they went away from that, and now there's tens of thousands of apps, it fundamentally changed the phone. Using another saying of mine, let 100 flowers blossom. And that made the iPhone just more successful. If the iPhone were not an open platform where you could write software today, I don't think it would be nearly as successful.
I think that's been. And so, whose decision was it to open it up? Do you know?
Yeah, this is one of those retroactive things. You'll never know the truth. Maybe Steve Jobs closed it down and he got bludgeoned into opening it up. Or maybe he closed it down initially because he wanted to ensure the launch was successful and he always intended to open it up. I tend to think that that's the story that will be told. I don't know if it's the truth.
Guy Kawasaki, thank you so much for joining me today on Fresh Dialogues. Thank you for listening to Fresh Dialogues. This is Alison Van Diggelen, with special thanks to Tom Kromkowski and Carol Pecora for technical support, and Kevin McLeod, who wrote and produced our music.